an entire monthly payment. Major demonstrations were held across the country to demand the government finally take action for adequate and stable shelter.
The government isn't proposing any solutions for these people with housing problems or who are completely homeless. These are people who work, who pay their taxes, and yet still find themselves on the streets. It's a big, big problem, but we don't expect anything from this government, given how they responded to the fair requests of the Yellow Vests.
Demonstrators demanded rent freezes and reductions, the taxing of real estate corporations and multiple homeowners, and the requisitioning of a record 3.2 million empty lodgings. However, historically, there have been few signs that the administration of Emmanuel Macron is interested in dialogue.
The 2024 budget has just been released, but don't expect to see it debated in Parliament. President Macron has just used his usual executive decree to force through yet another austerity budget with billions in cuts to government services despite the record economic hardship.
Macron uses the 49.3 executive decree, so the people remain silent. People are scared, and that's now our biggest problem. This fear has led to inaction and political apathy, and that's even though I hear everyone around me relating how bad things are going for them and for society. I don't understand their inaction, but I do understand their fear of getting involved, given the massive repression and lack of democracy here.
Many say that housing is actually an issue which any committed government can fix in just a few years. By making laws which favor tenants and not rich landlords, by putting more taxes into building public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As India gears up to hold the world's largest electoral exercise due in February 2024, violence against Muslims and other minorities has flared up across the country. Reports say the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and its affiliated groups are responsible for the escalating trend. Observers say the hate has reached even the parliament, which many describe as a temple of democracy.
This is something unusual in our country. The politics of hate has reached even schools, colleges and universities. Few weeks ago, I was literally terrified when some people pulled my dress on the street outside college.
Violence against Muslims has prevailed since the partition in 1947. That's when the subcontinent was partitioned into two independent nation-states, Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan. But with the emergence of the ruling BJP in 2014, the situation has become far worse. Muslims have witnessed systematic repression against the community, including hate speeches, hate crimes and mob lynchings. A recent incident inside the Indian Parliament sparked outrage when the BJP lawmaker hurled Islamophobic profanities while debating with a fellow Muslim lawmaker. In another horrific incident, a Muslim man was lynched in New Delhi for taking a banana at Hindu temple event.
I have a hard time selling vegetables on the streets now. A few months ago, I was harassed in a community, with many saying we won't buy vegetables from a Muslim. They called me by inappropriate names.
Since last decade, India has seen a growing fear and panic among minorities, particularly Muslims. There is a growing mistrust on the ruling BJP and its policies towards Muslims. The ruling party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, however, denies any allegation, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics argue that the real agenda is to promote Hindu supremacy in the country to garner votes and retain power.
With general elections few months away, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring up across the country. Minority communities are yet again becoming political tools for electoral gains. Experts say the ruling party is dividing voters on religious lines, which they say could lead to social discord in a country known as the world's largest democracy. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip have held a demonstration in support of Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds in the face of growing Israeli aggression against the Islamic holy site. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days in Al-Quds, with Israeli settlers backed by regime forces desecrating the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Hamas movement to organize the rally vowed to continue resistance until the liberation of all of Palestine.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is not alone, and we will protect it with our lives. The desecration of our holy site and digging tunnels under it will never give legitimacy to the Zionist enemy. The Palestinian people are in a constant state of resistance, and their resistance will continue to increase until the liberation of Al-Quds and every inch of our land.
People came out to express their support for resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. They stressed that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine, despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
Al-Aqsa Mosque belongs to every Muslim around the world and to every Palestinian. The Zionists are creating Al-Aqsa, and we believe that only armed resistance can liberate Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
We are here to tell the whole world that Palestinians are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. We will not remain silent amid the attacks on Al-Aqsa. Al-Quds will always be a Muslim city.
Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to their religious significance.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory say they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Grand Khatam al-Nabiyyin Mosque in Kabul was the venue for the ceremony celebrating the Prophet Muhammad's birthday and the Islamic Unity Week. The ceremony drew people from all walks of life, including religious scholars, Taliban officials, and students. The speakers emphasized the need for following the path of Prophet Muhammad in all aspects of life and strengthening the Islamic bonds.
God has introduced the Prophet of Islam as the best role model for humanity. Prophet Muhammad is the role model because he is the mercy of God for us. Following his path will bless us luck and good in the life and the hereafter.
The attendees of the ceremony also expressed their views on the occasion. Many of them said they were happy to see Muslims from different sects coming together and celebrating their common faith. They also said they hoped for peace and stability in their war-torn country.
Western countries have always tried to divide Muslims. This has been one of their plots to implement their goals and dominate Muslim territories. But fortunately, today, all our Muslim brothers are aware and won't let anyone divide us or create hatred among us. We should work together for the prosperity and security of our Islamic world.
The Islamic Unity Week is an annual event that is observed by both Sunni and Shia Muslims around the world. This is also an opportunity for Muslims to celebrate their common values. Following decades of invasion and war in their country, Afghan Muslims have gathered today to show their unity and brotherhood. They also voice support for other Muslims across the world in the face of global arrogance and oppression. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Motivated by a consistent campaign of the late anti-apartheid leader and former Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Anglican Church has now resolved to officially classify Israel an apartheid regime. It aligns with a decision by the South African Council of Churches, which has long been critical of the Zionist regime and its oppressive doctrine. The Archbishop of the Anglican Church, Reverend Thabo Makgoba, who is currently at the Vatican, said in an audio message that remaining silent on the continued oppression of the Palestinian people cannot be tolerated.
Our hearts ache for our Christian brothers and sisters in Palestine, whose numbers include Anglicans but are rapidly declining. People of all faiths in South Africa have both a deep understanding of what it is to live under oppression, as well as experience of how to confront and overcome unjust rule.
In its resolution, the church goes to lengths to underscore that solidarity visits must be carried out to Palestine, and particular efforts must be made to engage with the church in Al-Quds and ordinary Palestinian Christians to learn the true extent of their suffering under Israeli occupation. It acknowledges that until now, when Christians do visit Al-Quds, they often overlook the Palestinian reality, and in some instances are even taken on all expenses paid propaganda trips by the Zionist regime.
The fact that it's the birthplace of Jesus Christ, I think the question of language is very important, and the statement makes point of when pilgrimages are conducted from us as South Africans to Jerusalem, then the fact of the name of Palestine or Palestine is never mentioned. It's always Israel, and yet in Jesus' day it would have been Palestine.
While the Anglican Church has taken steps to talk about Palestine, it hopes the resolution identifying Israel as an apartheid regime will overcome the apathy which it says still prevails within the Christian community. The Anglican Church's decision comes ahead of an international conference on apartheid Israel in South Africa later this year. The Dutch Reformed Church is also expected to take a similar decision later this month, further emphasizing the plight of the Palestinian people. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
The historic Chehel Sutun Palace in Iran's central city of Isfahan hosted the award ceremony of the fifth edition of the Mustafa Prize. The ceremony was held with the presence of nearly 1,000 attendees, including the winners of this year and previous years, the head of the scientific working group of the fifth award, thinkers and presidents of various universities, and officials of scientific institutions. Addressing the attendees, head of the Mustafa Prize Scientific Working Group, Ali Akbar Salehi, hailed the remarkable scientific and technological achievements of Muslim scientists.
Development of science and technology is the result of collaborative work of scientists from all over the world, regardless of their nationality and cultural differences. Each of the scholars who will be awarded today have gathered here from every corner of the globe. They represent the best things that science can bestow upon humanity.
The award ceremony was held in two different sections. First, in the field of non-resident scientists, Professor Ahmed Hassan and Professor Omid Farrokhzad received their awards for their significant contributions in their respective fields of software engineering and nanomedicine. In his acceptance speech, Farrokhzad expressed his gratitude to his family and made an important announcement about the prize he has received.
I believe the Mustafa Prize is a symbol of scientific achievements that my father honored most. I dedicate this award to my late father, Colonel Ali Farrokhzad. Also, I donate the financial award to the Mustafa Foundation of Science and Technology to establish a new prize for junior scientists.
In the second part of the award ceremony, Murat Oysel from Turkey, Semia Khoury from Lebanon, and Ahmed Fauzi Ismail from Cambodia received their Mustafa medals for their outstanding work in advancing knowledge and improving the lives of people worldwide. The five laureates each received a sum of $500,000 financed through endowments made to the prize. The Mustafa Prize is a testimony to the contributions of the Islamic world in global scientific development. It inspires and encourages scientists and researchers in their pursuit of groundbreaking scientific innovations and discoveries. Mahdi Abbasian, Isfahan.
Suicide bomber from the Daesh terrorist group detonated his explosives last year, turning the large classroom of the Kaj Education Center into a bloodbath. 57 people died and more than 100 others were injured, mostly female students. 1 year on, the families and friends of the victims have gathered here to remember their lost loved ones and share their stories of grief and anguish. there is still mourning and suffering from the consequences of that tragic day.
Last year, on this day, I lost my beloved classmates forever and witnessed their dead bodies fallen on the floor. This whole year, I lived with the memory I had made with them and the tragedy of their martyrdom. I was wondering how to live with the pain of our lost dreams and hopes. Every second, I missed them, and this whole year was as devastating as hell.
The families of the victims say they have not received any justice for their loss. They urge the Taliban government to bring the perpetrators to justice and to provide a safe environment for Shia Hazaras to exercise their rights.
I call on the de facto government to bring to justice and punish the terrorists who killed our daughters at educational centers. Our students are the assets of the Afghan nation and should not be ignored. All Afghans have rights, including the right to peaceful education. This right should never be denied or stolen from us.
The attack also left many survivors, like Shahrbanu, with physical and psychological injuries. They are still undergoing treatment and therapy, hoping to resume their normal life and education.
After I was discharged from hospital, my physical injuries slightly healed, but my psychological wounds didn't. Since then, I've been depressed and shocked. I can't socialize or go out with friends. I'm seeing a therapist, and I hope this will help me get back to my normal life and continue my education.
The Shia Hazara community, which has faced decades of discrimination and persecution in Afghanistan, has been repeatedly targeted by Daesh and other extremist groups in recent years. Today, they want justice, peace, and security. This is a day of remembrance and solidarity for the victims and also families of the Khaj Educational Center attack. This is also a day of defiance and determination for the Shia Hazara people who refuse to give in to terror and hatred. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Senior U.S. officials have decided to continue to extend Washington's support to the Kiev government to carry on with a proxy war against Russia despite Ukraine's faltering counteroffensive. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The United States has announced $250 million in fresh military aid to Ukraine after it was revealed that Washington has decided not to give diplomacy a chance to resolve the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The U.S. announced the aid package on Tuesday, 29th of August, naming the components as equipment for clearing mines and obstacles, as well as missiles, artillery rounds, anti-armor missiles, and more than 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition. Kiev has already received more than $43 billion worth of weaponry from the United States in the form of weapon systems like howitzers and millions of rounds of ammunition, including widely banned cluster munitions, since February of 2022, when Russia started a special operation in Ukraine. Russia has said the steady flow of arms towards Ukraine would only prolong the conflict, which Moscow says the operation was started in order to defend the pro-Russian population of eastern Ukraine, regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. Meanwhile, Moscow has refused to rule out negotiations towards settling the conflict. Also, the United States has said it will begin training Ukrainian pilots to fly F-16 fighter jets soon, amid a race by Washington and its allies to provide Kiev with the American supersonic aircraft. Pentagon spokesman Pat Ryder said recently, these pilots will be conducting English language training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, in September, prior to attending F-16 flying training in Arizona the following month. Pentagon spokesman Pat Ryder added, the training will involve several pilots and dozens of personnel to maintain the aircraft. Recently, the United States told Denmark and the Netherlands they could transfer their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine when the country's pilots are trained to use them. A few days ago, Copenhagen and The Hague announced they would provide Ukraine with a number of F-16 fighter jets. Six of the promised jets will initially be delivered around New Year. Also on Thursday, 24th of August, Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre said Oslo would join the array of countries that are slated to ship the single-engine aircraft to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky strove for months to secure the fighter jets. Kiev views the F-16 fighter jets as vital to the success of its efforts to push against Russia. Russia says that the West's anti-Russian agenda, including its eagerness for inclusion of Ukraine in NATO, and therefore the Western military alliance's expansion right up to Russia's borders, effectively forced Moscow to launch its special operation in the former Soviet Republic. The Washington Post has also covered the same story and tells us more. Most senior U.S. officials have decided to continue to extend Washington's support to the government in Kiev to carry on with the proxy war against Russia, despite Ukraine's faltering counteroffensive. According to the Washington Post, they're not considering diplomacy and are expected to back Ukraine against Russia into next year and beyond by sending Kiev more weaponry and munitions. I heard this same sentiment across all levels of the U.S. government in recent days. The summer has been frustrating and in some ways disappointing for Ukraine and its Western backers. But rather than look for a quick diplomatic exit ramp, most senior U.S. officials appear more convinced than ever of the need to stand fast with Ukraine. In their view, the United States cannot be seen to abandon its ally. While the U.S. thinks Ukraine could still do some damage to Russian forces, it doesn't expect a decisive blow. U.S. officials believe strategic patience remains the best weapon against Russian President Vladimir Putin. That means a continuation of this grueling war into 2024 and beyond, and a continuation of the heavy casualties and emotional trauma for both sides. While the U.S. has already sent widely banned cluster munitions to Ukraine to help in its counteroffensive against Russia, the U.S. may send more types of cluster munitions which can kill and maim civilians for decades after the war has ended. For example, there's growing backing in Washington for providing rocket-launched cluster munitions which could strike deeper than the artillery-fired versions of the United States began supplying recently. The U.S. is expecting Ukraine to increase drone attacks on Russian territory. Before the Ukrainian counteroffensive, launched in early June with the core objective of severing Russia's land bridge to Crimea, Kiev was provided with an extra huge supply of arms and munitions in an attempt to further help Ukrainian forces make headway against Russian troops. Washington is still pressing Kiev to push the Ukrainian forces harder and concentrate the troops to make a push towards the Sea of Azov in the south. Russia has already called on the West to refrain from sending more weapons to Kiev, warning that it will only exacerbate the situation. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered the same story. Former Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte says NATO's strategy on Ukraine has failed in the ongoing war with Russia, stressing that Western efforts to arm Kiev and break Russia's economy are getting nowhere. Giuseppe Conte wrote in a post on his Facebook site on Saturday, 26th of August, NATO's attempts to defeat Russia in the Ukraine conflict have completely failed, as Moscow continues to stand tall amid Kiev's faltering counteroffensive and Western sanctions. Conte added, "There has been no disintegration of Russia's military and paramilitary departments. There has been no retreat due to the Ukrainian counteroffensive. The West's hopes for domestic political turmoil in Russia have also failed to materialize." Giuseppe Conte wrote, after a year and a half of hostilities between Moscow and Kiev, it was time to put aside the optimistic assessments fueled by superficial as well as deafening war propaganda in the West. Conte also said that the massive military aid to Kiev by the West and the logic of escalation has failed to bring about the much hoped-for demise of the Russian military. He said Ukraine never managed to push Russian forces back from Bakhmut. Bakhmut is a key Donbass stronghold that Russia captured in May after months of fierce fighting. Giuseppe Conte also slammed the European Union for lack of an autonomous political and economic leadership, failing to develop an effective common strategy and kowtowing to the US government. According to Conte, sanctions imposed on Russia by the United States and its allies following the start of the conflict last year did not produce the desired outcome and failed to isolate Russia. He said sanctions have not bankrupted it or crippled Russia's economy. The long-stated goal of isolating Moscow has by no means been achieved. Giuseppe Conte's comments come as the Ukrainian counteroffensive has failed to gain any significant ground despite more than 2 months of fighting. The former Italian Prime Minister, who held the office from 2018 to 2021, has in the past repeatedly called for peace talks and opposed further arms deliveries to Kiev, warning of a potential escalation of the war.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Crisis is a term that is associated with Europe these days more than other parts of the world. The country that is in the lead in Europe is the UK. A series of labor strikes and industrial disputes have occurred in various industries of the UK's economy as workers have walked out over pay and conditions, the most recent one being junior doctors and consultants. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why so many workers in so many different sectors of the UK are striking and whether the Sunak government has been able to handle the issue properly. First, let me introduce our guest for this program. Keith Philbin, Professor of International Economics and Finance at City University, joins us from London. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joins us from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Keith Pilbeam, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on this strike by doctors and consultants? It's a three-day walkout, but it is said that it's going to affect, obviously, the care that patients are going to need. And that's another whole question that I'm going to ask on that regard. But do they stand a chance? It sounds like the government has to come to the negotiating table, but are they going to do that?
Well, the government, let's be honest, is out of money. They wasted so much money during the COVID pandemic, etc. Yeah, PPE equipment. They don't have much money left. We still got a massive fiscal deficit in this country, all right? And therefore, there really isn't the money to make big pay rises in the public sector. So at the end of the day, the government must also realise that these strikes are extremely costly, because they're leading to people not getting their medical care on time. That means they're off work, not paying taxes, etc. So at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of compromise. It's going to be nowhere near the 35% catch-up the doctors would like. That's never going to happen, because it would just spark off further pressures in the public sector. But an inflation-matching pay rise is certainly something the government can afford. And we've got to remember that a lot of these people, you know, particularly consultants, they're getting taxed at 62% for quite a bit of their income, between £100,000 and £125,000.
I'm sorry, there's how much did you say? 62%.
62%? 62%. Yeah, because they lose their tax-free allowance, which is also taxed at 40%. So if you earn an extra £25,000, between £100,000 and £125,000, which a lot of consultants are in, £15,500 goes to the government and £9,500 goes to them. So not many people know about this, but this is clearly another thing that is, you know, really, I mean, the government wants to cut taxes for the wealthy, but won't cut it for the middle classes, who are being taxed outrageously at 62% for a certain amount of their income. It goes down afterwards, after 125,000, it drops down to 47%. Which is still pretty high, but it's 62%. And that actually gets a lot of doctors, you see. So Liz Truss, when she did these tax cuts for the very wealthy, okay, above 160,000, which, you know, that seems rather stupid, when she could have actually done something for these doctors that are between the 100 to 125,000, all right? So that's stupidity of the first order. And it's a stupid tax anyway. It's actually holding the economy back, because lots of doctors stop working when they've got £99,900, OK? No one wants to be taxed at 62%. I'm not making these figures up. They're facts. You can go to the HMRC website and check them out. So
I'm sorry to jump in, but I just checked out what you said in terms of taxes, and I put an average worker, and I'm shocked to find out that it says the UK's take-home pay of an average single worker after tax and benefits was 76.4% of their gross wage, compared to the OECD average of 75.4%.
Yeah.
How does that? This changes the whole tone of the program. How do you figure the government? What comes to mind is, if they're taking that much taxes away, it must leave the government more room to negotiate. But then they probably are banking on these taxes in terms of revenues that they're spending in other places, I'm guessing.
Well, you see, you also, when you earn your money, they take off income, national insurance off you and everything like that. But then, of course, they're taking VAT when you earn your spending money. So you're paying even more when you fill up your car with petrol. Right. You know, you put £100 in, £75 is probably off to the government.
Let me bring it.
So it's shocking rates of taxation we're facing. And basically, the government can't raise taxes anymore. That's clear.
Right. Let's bring in Tony Gosling in here.
Good on the wealthy.
Let's bring in Tony Gosling in here. Tony Gosling, I'm sorry to take so long to get to you, but this is just shocking stats on the tax issue where, aside from the government, putting that aside, how do people survive if that much taxes are taking out? Because that's something that was overlooked and not really spoken much about when it comes to the workers and the pay they're getting in terms of how much taxes that's being taken out.
It's built into the system. As there is inflation, as is now running food inflation nearly 20%, it's just coming down a little bit, but that's where it's been. So everybody is moved up into the higher tax brackets. And what they've been doing is they've not been moving the tax bracket. So people at the moment, on average wages, are being taxed like maybe a decade ago the super rich were. So these rates of tax, and it's the same with housing, exactly the same with housing. So, you know, say, for example, the inheritance tax thresholds haven't been raised, even though the price of housing is going up. So as the economy starts to fall apart, more and more middle earners and low wage earners are moving up into the high tax rates. And actually what's happening is work is no longer a way out of poverty. So people are starting to work and then finding that they're actually ending up with less money than they've had on benefits, and they just simply cannot pay the rent and they're being evicted from their homes, this sort of thing. So you're right. Welcome to basket case Britain, because the economy is in an absolutely terrible state. In a way, it's a kind of hybrid war, the same hybrid war that's being waged on Ukraine. And of course, if you think about it, but it's being waged on the British people as well. And if you think about the amounts of billions that have been spent on Ukraine, it's quite obvious the government does have the money to pay the doctors. They have a choice to make. Do they want that money to go to arms and to arming this proxy war we're doing for the Americans over in far distant Eastern Europe? Or do they want to pay doctors properly? And the fact of the strikes, I'm absolutely 100% with the doctors, because the doctors know that what's happening is the senior staff in the health service, particularly the professionals that are making the life and death decisions, the consultants, the doctors, the registrars, are moving abroad because the pay is too low here. They cannot afford to pay the rent, to pay the mortgage on those wages. And so they're going off to get much better wages abroad. And so they are the ones who are trying to save the health service by flagging up to the nation that they need to be paid proper wages in order to keep the NHS alive. And of course, if you think about the government we've got at the moment, the Conservatives have always wanted to destroy the National Health Service, this free health service for everyone in the country. The Conservatives don't like that. They want to go over to a American-style health insurance system. And actually, the American health companies are all, they've got very busy London offices because they are lobbying for this change too. So they're trying to destroy the National Health Service, and they're doing that by making sure the doctors just leave the country, flee the country and go abroad.
Well, let's move on beyond just the health service and take a look at other sectors of the UK economy if we can, because this thing about taxes has thrown me off. But Keith Pilbeam, nevertheless, I'd like to ask you about one of the things that are in the basket of expenses of an average person there in the UK and across the world, really, in a matter of speaking, and that's the cost of food. We know food prices have risen, but by how much have they risen? I'm trying to get an idea based on going through the inflation, which puts it at around 7 or 8%. But I think it's a lot more than that, because when you look at categories of food, or just food itself, whether it's margarine or eggs or other items, you can see that it's a lot more than that. It depends what you're looking at. It doesn't really come out to the 7 or 8% they're talking about. What's the story there?
Well, food inflation is much higher than 7 or 8%. It is actually around 17%. Of course, it depends. For different people, it'd be higher or lower, depending what food they eat. But food inflation has been running particularly high, which impacts the poorest people. You see, the headline rate of inflation, 6.8 now, but don't forget it was 10.9. That doesn't mean everything went up by 10.9 or 6.8%, all right? Some things go up far more. And of course, poor people spend proportionately more of their money on food. So the inflation rate facing poor people is substantially higher than the headline figure. Everybody knows that, the government knows that, and no one can deny it. So that is causing poor people problems because, you know, they spend more of their money on food and rent, of course, which has also been skyrocketing. So the Bank of England, I believe, is trying to do some analysis of this. But, you know, if you're in the lower 20% of British income, you're getting, you know, inflation plus tax rises and council tax going through the roof. It's miserable.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Tony Gosling, when I read this headline, I felt a sigh of relief for the people there in the UK, where The Guardian, I'm going to say the name, ran and said UK food prices fall in September for the first time in 2 years. But then you read the print below that, taking a closer look, it dropped by 0.1%. If we're looking at 19.4% or 19.1%, and they cited that as being food inflation for 2022, that's not much of a price drop, if you ask me. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot at all compared to rate of food inflation. What's the impact that it has had on poverty there in the UK?
Let me just explain. It's not really a price drop at all. What's been happening is these German-owned supermarkets, Lidl and Aldi, have been opening across the country. They've been doing very well and opening new stores over the last couple of years. And so what we're seeing is more and more people leaving the mainstream British supermarkets and going to these German cheapo supermarkets. And so therefore, that's the only thing that's really been bringing. The fact of the matter is that these massive food cartels have been price fixing. They know they've got pretty much a stranglehold on the market, that the small grocer shops dotted around the country, there's not many left, are really not able to compete with these massive supermarkets anymore. And so they do deals with the supermarkets as a cartel, and they've been slowly putting up the prices. In fact, there have been one or two supermarkets, such as Sainsbury's here in Britain, who have actually refused to stock products like Heinz products, for example, because these massive food conglomerates have been price fixing, and they're saying, well, this is far too much. We want to sell someone else's baked beans or whatever, and we're not going to sell yours because your price is way too high. Your margins are high. And of course, this is just being done to the benefit of shareholders, because they now have such a stranglehold on the food market that they can start to jack up prices anywhere they want. And I mean, this is, of course, as Keith says, it's affecting the poor far more. And that's the perversity of all of this, is that you've now got the rich paying virtually no tax. These are the people, by the way, if we wanted to raise tax, we've got lots of super rich people that we could be taking this money off from their investments. You know, say, for example, you've got hundreds of millions of pounds invested. Well, if you were to lose half of that, you wouldn't even notice a single difference in your lifestyle. And so that we should be morally doing. We should be grabbing that money, even if it is offshore, or if as soon sure. as we should, we need to take the money off the rich. And what's happening is with this food price inflation is the poor are being hit and the rich are being left scot-free. So it's almost certain. I mean, we've had the big speech today by British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak at the Conservative Party conference. They've got a general election next year, so it's probably his last chance to sell the Conservative vote to the voters. And he's come up with absolutely nothing at all. And he's talking about change, but we know that he's not changing anything. So it seems to me, and in fact I've heard this from insiders, okay. that there are many people at the top of the Conservative Party here that don't want to win the next general election. So they're not interested in dealing with these issues. They're only interested in looking at their apps on their phones to see how much dividends on their big share investments Indeed. That they're getting. That's their interest. The public and the voters are nowhere in the equation.
We're going to talk about it a little bit more, but I'd like to ask you an economic question here, Keith Pilbeam, because it seems like it's a contradiction, but yet it works out for the benefit of the economy somehow, which is why I want to ask you, and that's the deal with interest rates. All right, we know that there's interest rates that have been risen on a number of occasions by the central bank, and that is the way to tame inflation, for lack of a better word. But when you know when you raise the interest rates, it's got its pluses and minuses. Can you please explain to us how that works out? Because we know that there are obviously setbacks based on the impact it has on the different sectors of the economy.
Well, interest rates, of course, they've gone up. But what one must remember is that they were manipulated by the Bank of England to record levels for numerous years, barely below 1%. All right, so even on 10 years, the government could borrow, listen, at 0.6% with inflation target of 2%. That made no economic sense whatsoever, by the way. That's, you know, and all these people that invested in those bonds, including pension funds, by the way, that was stupidity of the highest order. I mean, no one should be lending to governments at 0.6% with an inflation target of 2%. All right. So now they can't print any more money. They've printed so much that it's actually one of the big causes of inflation. They won't admit it. Andrew Failey, I insist on calling him Failey, not Bailey. You know, he printed so much money, it's just incredible. 300 billion in 1 year to pay for all this COVID and fiscal deficits. So eventually, you see, that's going to come home to roost. And interest rates are bound to go up when inflation goes up. And now inflation is up and not really under control because people are still trying to catch up because they lost out last year on their wage rises, you know, less than inflation. So they're trying to catch up this year. It's not going to go down quickly. The Bank of England was, as usual, asleep at the wheel. They said inflation would go to 4.5, you know, well outside their target, by the way. Then it went to 6, then they were forecasting 8, then they forecasted 10. I mean, the Bank of England should be closed as an institution, you know, with its forecasting record, and the governor sacked. So we've got to get used to much higher interest rates, all right? Because we've now got record levels of debt. The government has borrowed so much money that the national debt has gone from, you know, to over 100% of GDP. Companies have borrowed too much, all right? When interest rates were low, what do? They borrow, borrow, borrow. And of course, people borrow to buy houses at absurd prices. And when interest rates go up, it's bound to hit the property sector.
Sure.
And many other sectors. Zombie companies, they've been kept alive through low interest rates, okay? But now interest rates are going up, those zombie companies have to liquidate, go bankrupt. And we're seeing that increasingly, bankruptcies everywhere. And it was all because of the incompetence of the Bank of England. They should not be celebrating getting inflation down to 6.8 or 5. It is ridiculously high. It is still well above the maximum of 3%. It's 2% plus or minus 1%.
Okay.
So this is not any success. This is failure. You can't celebrate failure of that degree and say you're doing something.
All right. Tony Gosling, you talked about Sunak. One of the things that has come out, and I'd like to ask from you, whether it's a reflection of the types of decisions that go against maybe improving the economy. And that was the cancellation, from what we understand, of the scrapping of the HS2, which was said that it would have cut journey times, would have created more space on the rail network, and also would boost jobs outside of London. What are your thoughts, first of all, on his decision on doing that? And tell us some of the flops that he has actually is guilty of when it comes to the economy, the decisions that maybe that he made that has impacted the economy negatively.
Well, look, these massive infrastructure projects like HS2 should never have been signed off in the first place. That money could far better have been spent on upgrading existing railways, opening maybe some of the railways which were shut in the 1960s, and that sort of thing would have been extremely good for the environment. But no, most of the pressure to sign those contracts to build this railway were there from the construction companies, because they've made an absolute fortune on this railway to nowhere. It is just from London to Birmingham, which is, there is an existing fairly good service there anyway, which they could have used maybe one-tenth of this money to upgrade that service. The whole thing is, I think, a contract fraud that was signed by the end of the last Labour government in 2009. And then the Conservatives, if they had had a proper look at the books, should have just scrapped it as soon as they came into office in 2010. But they don't like that. It's embarrassing. And there may be costs. They actually had Jacob Rees-Mogg quite bravely said that the whole thing should have been scrapped 5 years ago. He said that. So, you know, this is a disaster. It's good that it's gone. The other thing is, the other infrastructure project near me in Bristol is this Hinkley C nuclear power station. Again, there's no real guarantees this is going to deliver affordable electricity ever. And yet billions are being spent on these projects. I think it's just really about the construction contracts. Those companies are going to definitely get lots and lots of money, but there may be nothing at the end of it to deliver. So this is, I think, a massive fraud. Enormous mistakes he's made, Sunak. And, of course, the chances are he's never going to make it to win an election next year. No chance. It's most probably going to be a hung parliament, because the reason is because this has not been an economic crisis for everybody. The super rich 0.1% have done incredibly well out of this Conservative government. And they have actually seen their billions multiply. And those are the people who are calling the shots. And that's why it's almost impossible that Sunak, because he came out with something today about smoking, for example, which you think, well, this is not going to win you the election, mate. No chance. And so he's got nothing to offer, really, except empty words. And so we're probably going to see a Labour government next year. And the Conservatives are going to applaud their leader as he just drags them down. Into a black hole, never to be seen again.
All right, I got one last question over here. I was going to talk about how the rich got richer, but that almost sounds like a cliche. So, Keith Pilby, my last question is about manufacturing in the UK, where it is said that there's been a, not it is said, it's been on the decline, to the point where many headlines read why the government has actually abandoned the manufacturing sector. Is it that bad? Has manufacturing declined to the point that the UK doesn't really make anything anymore? In a minute, if you can, please.
Well, we've still got the manufacturing base, but it's been decimated by Brexit. And you see that in the car industry. You know, output is now half what it was in 2016. No one wants to invest here. You get the odd thing that comes up because the government's subsidising it. Yep. Second the subsidies run out, they'll be either asking for more money or closing these factories. So it's been in decline for many years. This government doesn't care about manufacturing. We do have some good manufacturers, by the way. But the death knell has been paperwork, bureaucracy and Brexit. Their closest market is, of course, now very difficult for them, especially small manufacturers. You know, they used to use the EU to grow a bit bigger. Now they don't grow bigger. They stay in the UK. And also, they can't get the parts so easily from Europe because they don't want to supply them because of the paperwork again. So it's all self-inflicted. It's, you know, the whole country's gone to pot, really. And it's incompetence of the government. It's not just Brexit. It is the most incompetent government we've probably ever had in the last 10 years. I can't think of any government over the last 10 years, including, you know, that includes Boris, of course. But this shambles is just 13 years of disaster.
Yeah, okay, but 30 seconds, yeah, but, 30 seconds, Tony
Dawson. Yeah, okay, well, look, the trouble is that Britain lost control of its industrial policy, not because of Brexit, but when they entered the EEC back in the 1970s. Britain has never had, Britain's governments have never had control of their economic policy. At least we still got the pound, which gives us a little bit of leeway. And ultimately, I'm afraid Britain is not going to be, and it's not just Britain, it's the whole of Europe. Germany
Indeed.
Is now
okay.
slumping its manufacturing base. So Britain
Thank
can
you.
Shake hands with the Germans and say we're going to go down together.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you. Tony Gosling, their historian and investigative journalist. And thank you, Keith Pilby.